Hi everybody, thanks for coming. You'll see that we added a theme of design to the program this year. And that was at my instigation because I'm very interested in where design makes a difference to our lives. I can't remember, Zahira and I were trying to establish what did I see that led me to Zahira Asmal. And I can't remember what was the link that got me to her. But Zahira Asmal is one of those people who's interested in innovation and that design.
Please try again.
For the very purposes of improving our lives, for making the spaces we live in better, for making, and this is a nice big claim, and it's always good to make big claims, isn't it? For making our democracy better, for actually helping us be a nation in the world. So I'm really looking forward to what Zahira is going to say now, and thank you very much for coming. It's lovely to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm so happy to be here. It's the first time I'm at the National Arts Festival, so I'm very pleased, and I'm also super pleased that design is on the agenda. Thank you for joining me today and for your time. And this is a great opportunity for me to share our research and our ideas, some of our concerns. A lot of us have concerns about South Africa and our dreams. So I'm hoping at the end of this talk that you'll have an enhanced view on design and hopefully a different perspective on South Africa. I'm also hoping that we can explore together different ways of designing a democracy and also designing a better life for all. I'm Zahira Asmal. I'm the founder and managing director of an organization, a non-profit organization called Designing for All, and Designing South Africa and Designing Brazil sit under this non-profit. So today I will focus, focus this presentation on the work of the organization since our inception in 2009. And then I'll talk a little bit also about our history and achievements. I think it's important to celebrate successes in order to reflect and to know how best to move forward. I will also talk a bit about our past program, Design Cities and the World Cup, which we concluded last year, and our current program, Designing Our Democracy. And then in between all of this, I'll talk about national identity, public infrastructure, designing services, media, and its role in procurement of design. While researching for Designing South Africa and Designing for All when I started many years ago, well actually just, sorry, 4 years ago, I was studying design and its role in public services. And then I realized a better life for all. Well, that is our ANC, our government slogan, a better life for all. And I thought, well, the work that we're doing as designers and design activists is so closely linked with the work that government is doing. So how is it that government is not engaging more in design? So we talk about infrastructure and not the design of the infrastructure, so the thought process that goes and the blueprint before that. And then I thought, I liked how a better life for all deconstructed. You design better, so for designers, design life. Everything that we engage with, from all this that we're touching and engaging with, has all been designed. Whether it's good design or bad design needs to be considered, but it's still design. And design for all, particularly relevant in South Africa and developing economies. Are we designing fancy things for fancy people, or are we designing public things for public people, for people in general? Just before I proceed, I have got posters here from our exhibition in London, and people feel free to take them. And you know this is quite an important theme for me, so it's design a better life for all. And gold, because it's a golden opportunity, and there's information on Designing South Africa at the back. We're going to be talking about our book on Friday, so I have some order forms if people are interested, and we have special rates for the festival, so please feel free to take those. I'm going to show you some slides from my book, or the book that we published last year, and that we launched in 8 cities. And so a lot of these slides are from the book. And this image, I think some of you will recognize, is a David Goldblatt photograph, which I feel very honored to have in our publication. And this is the beach. And this image resonates with me because it says a lot about design's inability to move forward in South Africa. So this is a design space. There's graphic design, there's signage, saying to people,
like Slex Blancus, which I'm sure many of, you know from our history. So, and this reminds me of my childhood. And this is why I think it resonates so strongly with me. So when I was a kid, my dad and I used to, I come from a tiny town on the northeast coast of South Africa, so between Durban and Richards Bay. It's just sugarcane in the ocean. And so east coast being the Indian Ocean. My mom is Burmese Iranian and my dad is Indian, of Indian descent. And so we used to go fishing every Sunday. And this once, the time that I remember, we got kicked off the beach. And I was like, oh, but why? This is where the cool things are happening. And as a child, I didn't understand. And so my dad said, look, we have to leave because we're Indian. And I said, Dad, I just learned at school that, I mean, this is the Indian Ocean, you own the beach, surely, like, this is our place. But not quite. And so in 2001, at my final year at university, I was also kicked off the beach. 2001, Central Beach in Plettenberg Bay. So this is when I started to interrogate design's role in making spaces better for all. So if these signs were torn down in 1994, preceding 1994 when we became a democratic nation, what did we put in its place? So did Slex Blancus just become blank? And nothing went in its place to say, you are welcome for all. And I bet you in 2001, if the sign said, everybody welcome, this group of people wouldn't have asked me to leave the beach in 2001. So I feel design had done a disservice. So it was badly designed. And so in 1994, we claimed we were a democratic nation. But what does that mean? What systems did we have in place? Was this announced to anybody? And how was it announced? We said Rainbow Nation, but what did that actually mean? And so we said we were one vision, one country, a brand in total. But that didn't actually filter through. I mean, I didn't understand what that meant. I still felt a bit Burmese and Indian and Iranian living in South Africa, but I didn't know what that meant. I was still getting kicked off a beach, so I was still, you know. Someone hasn't been communicating this, or we haven't been communicating it together. And so the images, we felt, you know, amazing. In 1994, we had a great leader, and we wanted to move forward and share the world, share ourselves with the world. But these were the images that the world was seeing. So the positive images of South Africa were, well, Madiba for sure, and then our flora and our fauna and the animals and the beaches and Table Mountain. And so people always associated the positivity around our natural wonders and one person, Madiba. And then everything negative around South Africa were people-oriented. So HIV, poverty, crime. And so I wondered, then with all the positivity that we are doing individually in arts and culture and design, technology, why aren't we showing that ahead of elephants? I love elephants, but I love people more. And so I was wondering why the people engaged activities were not being shown internationally or even locally, so we would have more confidence in ourselves. Where's our sprawling cities? Images, this is Johannesburg at sunrise. Beautiful photograph. When I show this internationally, people think it's New York. It's Johannesburg. A lot of activities happening in Johannesburg. Why aren't we discussing them? So when the Gautrain station just opened, when it opened in 2010, ahead of the World Cup, there was this huge billboard outside the station that showed a safari. And so imagine if you arrive on the Gautrain and you go, I arrived in Joburg, I just go to Kruger National Park. So it doesn't say to people, stay in our city, engage with our people and know us better. Why isn't this image on, you know, the Gautrain saying, you've come to Sandton to do business, go to Newtown and watch and go hear some jazz in the evening? These are visual cues, and these are designed cues that haven't been shared. And so leading up to the World Cup, I was feeling really anxious about all these images that I was seeing internationally and locally, and I thought that we had really low self-confidence. People were saying, oh, we'll never make it, we don't have what it takes, people should consider Australia as Plan B, and all of those things that you remember from the World Cup. So what I thought to do was to bring the global media. And what I really dislike is someone has to write an article in cold Berlin or London about sunny South Africa. So I wanted to bring them over individually to South Africa, into our cities, because this is where all democracies get played out, in cities.
And so I wanted them to experience cities firsthand, meet designers and architects and artists, as well as the commissioning agents. So the mayor needs to sit with the designer and urban planner and the media and start talking about all these projects. So the hook was to bring them for the World Cup and those developments, but alongside all of that, I revealed to them other democracies. So housing, education, healthcare, this is the Constitutional Court, a really amazing, a well-designed democratic space. Every part of the Constitutional Court went out to public commission. So in essence, every part of the Constitutional Court was democratically designed and created, and everyone felt a part of it. What an amazing piece of architecture and design. So what we did was we brought people from these countries before, during, and after the World Cup. They all got a very specific topic, and while I showed them World Cup developments, we also took them to other democratic activities that were happening in the city. So in this image, you see us filming, that is the chief editor of Wallpaper magazine. I'm not sure if you're familiar. It's a very highly regarded lifestyle and design publication with 150,000 copies sold worldwide. I mean, you find them at kiosks in Buenos Aires as well as Berlin. And this is one of the architects of the Constitutional Court. So while we had them over, we also filmed and photographed their tours of all these spaces to create an online documentary. So we showed them the new airports, the new developments. This is the Cape Town train station, Gautrain, the bus services. And these are all like gleaming new products and services that we had in South Africa at the time. This you may have noticed, each bus station is curated with a very particular bespoke art piece. And that is amazing for Johannesburg. Johannesburg lacks a center, so the graphic designer created around the World Cup two, because the stadiums as the two central focal points, so people navigated around these two, which is quite novel for the city of Joburg. And then we also explain the processes of construction, design, and development of all these projects. So while we show this to the media, we show that to the public, and this was accessible to a global audience, and all online, and people could access it at any point. And this was hugely successful undertaking by Designing South Africa. So instead of just getting to a final piece of design and architecture where people play, engage, and have fun, but the thought processes and the systems that went alongside that, or ahead of that, rather. So all of these very familiar images. Also, we wanted to show, this is the first time, possibly, that city spaces were activated in such a way. And this is why we did this two-year program, Design Cities and the World Cup, because we wanted to show city makers and city officials what are the opportunities in cities. In European cities, people engage differently, more freely. In South African cities, it's not quite open for everybody to engage. And the World Cup did allow that to happen. Public infrastructure moved and transport moved, and the public spaces were completely activated. So if you were in Joburg around the World Cup, people could send instant messages on buildings. I mean, how fabulous. This was an incredible piece of design activation that happened. The only other time you'd see this many people at the parade was when Mandela was a free man. Mm-hmm. Why are we waiting for only like these momentous occasions to activate public spaces in South Africa? How can we make this more of an activity in our cities? Because when more of this happens, then people become more engaged with their city, they feel like they own their city, and they'll start doing more things with the city rather than waiting for governments to activate this. I mean, can you look at this crowd? No one's thinking apartheid, no one is thinking segregation. They're all coming together as a South African people and really having a good time. So I think as a nation, we need to use our systems to activate these a little more. Another great project that happened around the World Cup was this Football for Hope Center in Khayelitsha. And now it's used as an educational center. Also, the top part of that pillar gets lit up at night, so it becomes a safety zone for Khayelitsha. And this is dotted around Khayelitsha, so if there are any times of doubt or people feel unsafe, they know that this place can that they can seek refuge in this place. So also a good a piece of architecture by AIG Design, by Geeta Govind and her team. And so, well, these are empty spaces now because these are architectural photographs. But this, on a week, I was there on a Sunday. There, it's buzzing with hundreds of people. People are activating these spaces. And when people have beautifully designed public spaces, they'll engage with it more. And look at these kids. I mean, this is just, well, this picture says it all. They're very cute. And so this is Soweto, Nike. So this is the other opportunity. So where government is not coming in, there's also opportunities for corporates and the private enterprises to come in and activate public space. This was a building in Soweto around the World Cup as well. And this is still used as a training facility for not just for football, but also for people to learn about HIV, how to about education and practice, how to be safe, but also it's a daycare facility, and it's fully equipped with the Apple Macs and all of that, so people can learn there. It's a library as well. So we touched on, you know, all our other innovations, vuvuzelas and our craft. And so we created, this is our multimedia documentary that was accessible to a global audience around our past program. And so due to this initiative with Design Cities and the World Cup, that two-year program that we held around the World Cup, Design in South Africa was included in the top 20 in Wallpaper magazine. As you can see, Cape Town was also featured on the cover. Just to give you an idea, Wallpaper, the cover of the magazine costs about 1.7 million rand. And so, well, I guess no particular city is going to pay that much. But when you actually engage the media in a knowledgeable way, then the media will respond. And so we were also named Best of the Web in 2010 by Design Week. We were included in the Hot 50 also by Design Week, Monocle Design Directory in 2012. And Johannesburg, due to its efforts with public transport, public space, was named third best city, design city in 2011 after Hong Kong and Chicago. All this media came to about 8.89 million rand, excluding broadcast. Just featuring World Cup and all our World Cup developments, design, and South African cities in a 12-month period. So while I was doing all of this, and so this, I'm just going to show you some of the features and some of the spreads. These present here, the architects based in Johannesburg. On the left-hand side, the first two are from 2610 Architects, and they do social housing projects in South Africa. And then there's Jeremy Rose from Mashabane Rose, and they've done many heritage buildings. They've done the Apartheid Museum and the Freedom Park in Pretoria. And then there's Mpeti Morajele, who's done the Faraday Market in Johannesburg, as well as the South African Embassy in Berlin. And then the last two had worked on the, well, amongst many other projects, like the one below. You can see the Alice Lane project. But they've also worked on the Cape Town Stadium, and that's Henning Rasmus from Paragon. So these are some of the spreads that appeared in Wallpaper and other magazines that we had invited. So I will talk more about the book on Friday, but basically the brief was for the media that came to South Africa around the World Cup period was to produce or to publish an article on their specific topic, and then submit it to us as part of our documentary. And I'll talk more about that on Friday. So they had to submit it, as you can see, there was Mexico and Spain, and so they had to submit it in their language and in English, so we could publish it in our book. And so while we were working through this process, I wondered, besides the publicity for South Africa and all the amazing images, the publicity for projects or initiatives by these designers would have not reached the light of day. Because as you could have seen, the World Cup initiatives focused, or the like CNN and BBC and all of the others, focused on the football itself and basically the disasters and tragedies that went around it, and some happy stories from the townships. No sophisticated design. In fact, most of the design stories, apart from Designing South Africa's activities, were always about how GMP, the German architects, or the Americans, or the Italians were doing such a great job in South Africa. But what about the designers in South Africa? So the difference is, these big global companies have access to the big media. South African designers don't. And I think this is why Designing South Africa's activities were so successful in taking these stories and actually telling the stories openly and in a very fruitful way. And so not only was there publicity for the projects, there was also publicity for the individual designers. And since then, a lot of them have been commissioned either on public works elsewhere. I know Henning got for Paragon in Angola and Mozambique, amazing because of their World Cup work and the publicity that went along with that. And then, as well as the individual designers in wallpaper, they got commissions from Canada and the US, which is really successful for them. And so what I wanted to know is, through the storytelling, what South African identity, and that part of also being a democracy, what does this reveal about our identity internationally? Who's telling the story? So is it, as I mentioned before, a person sitting in a cold desk, behind a cold desk in cold London, writing about sunny South Africa, or is it South Africans through the global media and through our own channels telling the stories about South Africa? What does that reveal about our national identity? So locally, when we engage with it, how do we feel about it? And then when we see it on global publications like the Financial Times and Wallpaper, how do we receive this? And how does it make us feel about our national identity? Does it reveal any parts of our culture? And subsequently, does all of this become archived and tell stories later on a greater South African society? And then also, what role does the media in these kind of spaces, what role does it have in the procurement process? How are people buying design? Firstly, individually, like I've mentioned, from Paragon architects or from the product designers that we've seen, are they buying graphic design from the various agents that have been featured? Or is there a role for the Department of Trade and Industry and Arts and Culture and Brand South Africa and South African Tourism to sell South Africa's national identity in this way? So these are kind of the questions as part of our designing our democracy that we're trying to interrogate. So the procurement process, but also the archive of South African identity. So what are the opportunities for South African designers and artists to get major projects in Brazil, for instance, after the World Cup? So is the Department of Trade and Industry saying, hey, these are all our designers, you choose that person for identity, graphics, and stadiums? As far as I know, not a major effort has happened. What I have seen with the Department of Trade and Industry is we have, as South Africa, represented Telkom's ability as well as like the engineering ability, but not of design or art and culture, which is missing. So what are the opportunities for governments to engage designers collectively and to take a package to different parts of the world? To Russia and Qatar, for instance, where perhaps their design is always, I mean, for instance, in Russia and Qatar, their design is being outsourced. I used to work for an architect in London, and he got a lot of Russian work and work from Doha, mainly because they don't have the expertise there. So how is South Africa selling itself there? That also forms part of our national identity. So are we presenting our expertise alongside gold, diamonds, and the colonial game hunting term of the Big Five? Are we? I mean, these are questions we have to ask ourselves and ask the government. Are we presenting art, design through interesting projects and with public-private initiatives? And so what we have taken to, what Designing South Africa has done is to take all of these kind of questions and present them on an international platform. So last year we took an exhibition to the London Architecture Festival. It was South Africa's first ever representation at the London Architecture Festival. So that too, I wonder, well, when I was speaking to the British Council who had invited us, they said they had gone to the Department of Arts and Culture for this invitation, and no one answered the phone, as they also went to the South African High Commission, and no one answered the phone there. Apparently South Africa's High Commission was the only High Commission that didn't respond to the invitation to participate at this festival. And so we were happy to do it, completely underfunded. So a lot of it we had to take from, you know, from our savings to make this happen. Even SIA, South African Institute for Architecture, was not there. So these are the questions about, you know, national identity and how we represent ourselves globally. Because, for instance, architects have to pay about 2,000 rand to be part of SAIA. But is SAIA really representing the architecture in fraternity in South Africa? Or organize four-year-old organizations like Design in South Africa doing so? And so I just want to also touch a little bit about our successes or our accolades in the past few years. We're officially 3 years old, but from concept, 4 years old. This is a picture of that was part of our book tour last year. That is Mayor Fortunati of Porto Alegre in Brazil. And you can see it's a full room, and it was also like simulcast to an adjacent room to students. And so over the 3 years, we've given 32 presentations at 11 universities and design schools, at 9 conferences, 1 national arts festival, glad to be here, and 10 global cities. And all representing South African identity, design, and opportunities that we can be part of a global discourse on design, but also that practice. How can South African design plug in to global projects? We also had the first city and design panel discussion at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, which I'm very proud of. Danny Jordan invited me to sit on his panel at SoccerX in 2011. We also presented, and this was the invitation, we had a big design event at Trafalgar Square at South Africa House, hosted by Brand South Africa and Wallpaper. We had the first design presentation at the International Travel Show in Berlin. And this is also by pushing South African tourism and tourism markets to identify design's role and the importance of cities alongside Kruger National Park and natural resources that we have. And we also gave the first presentation ever at this huge architecture festival in Italy. And a book that we presented last year in 8 cities over 15 events in 3 months, which was quite challenging, but quite an amazing, rewarding experience. The book is in English and Brazilian Portuguese because they're hosting the next World Cup, and the book focuses on the design of the World Cup. And these are the cities we took the book to. And this, I don't know if anyone knows Folha de São Paulo. It is the biggest newspaper in Brazil, and with about, I believe, about 10 million readership. I mean, we don't even understand that kind of scale. And they featured the book before our book tour. And we made it on TV Globo, which is the biggest TV network in Brazil. And this was complete luck from a chance meeting with one of the directors a year before our book launch in Brazil. And so just our book tour through Brazil, according to their media stat information, came to about $467,000 in publicity and coverage. So quite great for South Africa and Brazil. And so what is happening now is that Brazil is calling, we're calling to South Africa for more of an engagement. So I get calls and emails quite regularly to engage South African designs, but on a grassroots level. So they say, we're not talking about your government organizations. Whereas 2 years ago, when I first engaged Brazil on the subject matter, they wanted to meet the CEO of tourism. They wanted that kind of level of information. Now they want public engagement. What can the ordinary designer, citizen, entrepreneur make, how can they make the most of their opportunities with the World Cup and Olympics? And they're speaking, they're engaging us in those conversations. So this is the book. That's the English side, and if you just flip over the book, it's Portuguese. It's not a mirror, so the images are different, but in the center it meets the same way two nations meet and hopefully share information. I've just got a few slides from the book. So the reflections part are the media features that, especially commissioned media features, and the opportunities are essays that we commissioned for ways that that South Africa can use missed opportunities to be better and just engage in our city spaces more democratically and in better ways, but also how South Africa and Brazil can come together and share information and be closer. Because most of the time, it's sometimes just language that's the barrier. And if we can get through that and communicate in many ways, through our artistic references, through our design, and just through opportunity, then people will come together. So while developing this program for Designing South Africa, I realized that the World Cup had mobilized people in South Africa to kickstart initiatives that our democracy should have done. We had, you know, improved public spaces, people came together. We had improved signage. For instance, I'm not sure if you realized, all the airport signages have changed for 2010. Before that, I'm not sure, even with our 11 languages, they were still restrictive. So what AXA had realized, airports company South Africa had realized before the World Cup, that they were going to be hosting people from Sweden alongside Mexico. How are they going to navigate these people to move through the airport quickly? So they had commissioned grid design to change nationally all the airport signage, but only for the World Cup. With 11 official languages, we should have done that in 1994. So that's just one example of how the World Cup had brought people together to galvanize activities that our democracy hadn't done. And so, with all of this in mind, we wanted to interrogate the concept of designing a democracy. What is it that goes into a democracy? The simple images that I showed you about public space, signage, those are democratic spaces that we need to consider and bring people together in a more inclusive way. And so I wanted to, for the next 2 years, because we're considering our 20-year democracy celebrations next year, and it's become quite a focal point, to talk about what I've been talking about all this time, about designing an identity. It's not something about just putting rainbow nations and flags everywhere and to say, oh, look, we're all together now. How do you design that system? And then how do you share it with South Africans? How do you tell people that you are all welcome and you're part of it? How do you tell entrepreneurs that this is the way you can be better at your business and sell to everybody rather than us and them? I remember my first job in 2001, sitting in a boardroom with our directors, and they said them, they were referring to them in the whole meeting. And I'm like, who's them? And they said, black people. And I'm like, oh, why don't you just ask us? And this is a weird thing, and I suspect this is still happening in many companies, about the them out there, what do you people do, and that kind of thing. So how do we do that in business? How do we do it in imagery? How do we do it in communication? Are we actually engaging? Are we starting our briefs with a conversation, or are we just plugging and playing in different ways? So what we want to do in the next 2 years is to interrogate this identity, interrogate healthcare and education, housing. These are really big topics, but we have to start somewhere. These are all big topics most people are shying away with because I hear from government, oh, we can't win. But is it really about winning, or is it really about providing a basic service to all South Africans? And so this is an image from the Shanghai Expo in 2010. I wonder who wrote the brief for this expo that we participated in 2010. This is a world expo. Nations from all over the world come to participate. South Africa was one of them. And we put a beaded lion in center stage. I have nothing against ethnicity, but what are we talking about? What is our direct message? And what are the various platforms? And so what we want to do is we want to engage artists and architects and designers to come together to tell us about what are the opportunities to show ourselves in a coherent, curated way. Because I would love to know who wrote that brief and was it successful? Did they take the best people to Shanghai and say, this is the best South Africa has to offer? Please, I want to be reminded, is this the best South Africa has to offer? I doubt that. I doubt a 1990s beaded lion at center stage is the best South Africa has to offer. And who are the decision makers that thought that this was okay? And where are the cultural curators, and why aren't they working with architects and designers to produce all this amazing work that I've seen, that is right here at the Arts Festival? And we are the ones that are perpetuating the stereotypes. We can't blame anyone else. We can't fault the Americans for believing that lions roam our streets. And so what systems, what design systems do we have in place? And so we want to kind of explore this in the next years. So the reason I pulled out this image, this was the winning pavilion at the Shanghai Expo that year. This is a design by an architect named Thomas Heatherwick. And he called this building, it's not a rendering, by the way, it's an actual photograph. And that his building is called the Seed Cathedral. So he also had to go through a whole tender bidding process and all of the painful parts that come with that. But he was adamant that Great Britain had to tell a story that is not all about selling things all the time in like, oh, trade, all about the Queen or about trading with us. And he said, people will understand a concept. So what he had created, if you can see, I'm not sure if you can see, but each of those little boxes contained seeds. And so his idea was that you come in and be inspired, that all good things start with an idea, a thought, and a seed will germinate. And so as you can see, that it, that it germinates in the outer space. And he's also created a public space where people can just marvel and understand that concept that they've created. And this won the best design at the Shanghai Expo. And eventually, the government, who had he had to debate with quite a bit, were very pleased with the activation. And so this is the reference points that I've been taking to the South African government in this past year. I've been taking into tourism, I've been taking into Brand South Africa, to ask, do we really need to be so basic? Where's the sophistication in our ideas? Where are the designed ideas? Where are our artists? Why aren't our artists being called in to show the best that South Africa has to offer? Also, I think sometimes we get so mixed up of finding ideas that sometimes we just need the artists to lay it out there and we'll figure it out. You know, as you leave and as you wander through aisles and watch, I just watched Biko's Quest yesterday, which created more questions for me. But that's the whole idea, right? That you leave going, oh, that really evoked something in me. And then you kind of deconstruct it in your own time. And so this was a project in the Venice Biennale, the Art Biennale, by Chris O'Feely and David Adjaye. And this too, a beautiful piece of architecture and art coming together. And so if you imagine, this is Great Britain's pavilion. So if you imagine, when we think about something stiff and a little dull when you think about Great Britain, this doesn't say anything about that. It shows the livelihood and the liveliness of what Britain has come to be these days. London is so cosmopolitan. If you think about the two artists, the architecture and artists, they're both of African descent. And so this also tells an amazing story for Great Britain. And one that you don't actually have to stuff in people's noses. You can just, by just interacting with these spaces, you understand and leave going, ah, I feel more informed and I feel smarter. And so, no, that's totally fine. I don't mind the ad break. I'm just gonna use as an opportunity to have a bit of water. So while we're interacting with identity, which is a greater theme, we also wanna talk about our identity in cities. As I said before, cities are a great place where democracies are all played out. We're all interacting, we're jostling against each other, sometimes happily, sometimes not so happily. And so cities are the places where these experiments can happen, where we can actually find out where are the democracies, how can we plug into them. And so how is our national identity featured in our cities, in our buildings? So I've just talked about exhibitions where we show ourselves internationally. But what about the spaces that we're just interacting with every day? Our buildings. In Johannesburg, I've seen ghastly Balinese-inspired Tuscan villas. But where's the South African architecture? Do we necessarily have to have an architecture, or can we just use light? Johannesburg has amazing light. Are architects using the light and local products and resources to just create good housing, rather than feeling having low self-esteem and referring to Tuscany? Without actually having that heritage. But is it important to have a national identity in our architecture and design? So these are the questions that we are thinking about at the moment. Or is South Africa too young to even explore that as a democratic nation? So will our identity emerge? I think one of the very successful projects, and an image I showed earlier, was the Circa Gallery in Rosebank. I'm not sure if you're all familiar with that. It's a beautiful piece of architecture done by Studio Mass in Johannesburg. And what they had done was just to channel the light that Johannesburg has, and it has amazing light throughout the year. And because Johannesburg is a mining city, they used sleepers to actually create the space and the curvature of the building. So simple, truly South African architecture and very rooted in Johannesburg. And so are we also creating spaces that is for learning, for working and playing, but that is also beautiful and that we are proud of? Are we going to look at our spaces and our buildings and say, I belong here? Instead of, oh, are we ashamed and going, oh, everything's breaking and falling apart, I don't want to be a part of this. And are we doing that for everybody, or are we only doing that for a select few, making South Africa even more exclusive and inaccessible to many people? So these are further questions that we have. And so these are also images from the book, or slides from the book, and this image is a David Goldblatt photograph, 1961 evening exodus. So in our cities, and you can see a clear division in this image, 1961 and 2010. And this is an actual photograph. It's not a created image for publicity. This is Bloemfontein Stadium, 2010. And so what we want to explore is how can we use our public spaces and these arenas to move from separation to inclusion, and people feeling comfortable. I have to say, I still feel jittery going to Bloemfontein, mainly because when I was younger, well, firstly, but as you know, during apartheid, we weren't quite allowed through certain parts of the Orange Free State. We needed visas and check-in points and all of that. And I have quite a few anecdotal stories about that with my dad. But also, I mean, I was at a restaurant in Bloemfontein and asked to leave a restaurant. So I think people, although we have a democratic nation, I don't think we've informed everyone about it. And so I think this is the part of the challenges for our work is to explore that. This is a photograph, and I just wanted to just like shove this in, and I just put this in this morning because this is an amazing piece of architecture that shows a democratic space. This is the CESC Pompeii in Sao Paulo, designed by Lina Bobardi. And this space, you know, the buildings on the left and right, you can see they connect. And it's a stacked building. They have tennis courts, swimming pool, a soccer field, and I think it's badminton or something. All stacked on top of it. So you talk about a dense city, there's an opportunity to have a recreational facility where it's all stacked. And then they have a place, the other side of the building, are educational centers for kids. So all this interaction is continuously happening to every day. And then on the lower ground floor, on the right-hand side, is a theater. So a proper theater where plays and music, music events happen. And adjacent to that is a creche. So there's screaming kids going, ah! And right next door to it is a place where old people hang out. So it's not an old age home, but it's just a place where old people can be. And the part on the left is one of the coolest cafes and restaurants that I've been to in Brazil, and mostly accessible too. Brazil's very, very expensive. But this place is very affordable. And so these juxtapositions of old and new and young, it's amazing. This is a truly, truly democratic piece of architecture that I'd like to see in South African cities. And so I want to move on to, I know we're running short of time, so I'm just going to end off here with a part that I feel that is a little more important than the structures and the buildings that we create, but the systems that we create and the services. So right now I'm still researching housing, and so I've been consulting with a lot of architects at 2610, one-to-one, so public, the architects that are involved in public engagement. And so, not being an architect myself, this is the technical parts go over my head, but the parts, the social elements, are very close to my heart. And as you know, coming from this Asmal world, particularly important considering our family. And so, I've been doing a lot of research on why social housing is not being successful in South Africa. And the part that has been revealed to me is that we're creating structures rather than the services. So these are the buildings we're creating. These are RDP houses, also photographed by David Goldblatt. It's called Unfinished Houses. And what has been created by the government, firstly, during apartheid, if you can imagine that this is the city of Johannesburg or a city in South Africa, a
apartheid planning had people on the periphery of the city, in essence the periphery of society, and then the periphery of any kind of economic opportunity. But what we're currently doing is putting people even further away from that, instead of developing what is already there. So if I think people will take care of themselves. So in the sense that they know to put a roof over their heads. So this is Dipsloot. In 1994, this was a temporary measure by the ANC. And so the point that I'm trying to make is that we need to provide services within the structure that already exists, rather than having to place people on the periphery, even further on the periphery of society and economic opportunity. So our challenge as designers and governments and architects is how do we create the basic services of water, sanitation, economic opportunities at the places that they exist. So that's the part that our current focus for Designing South Africa is. We're engaging with these architects and we're pushing government to come see these projects and to meet people. Because I think people, this kind of public participation or residential, resident participation is very important because they know what their daily realities are. They know, they experience it and they're feeling it every single day. No architect will be able to, from outside, be able to tell them what to do, and no government will be able to do that. As you can see, it hasn't been successful since 1994. So we urgently need to supply society with more engaged architects who practice responsibly, empathetically and usefully. So not just architects that design fancy homes for fancy people. We need to supply society, governments that care, and a public that is more aware. And so I'm going to leave you with this image and also with a thought about how we all as individuals can lobby government to actually create the services in these existing places, like basic services, but also just to engage each other in what we would like, what would make us happy. Because the democracies are not different in Dipsloot than it is in Camps Bay. They're the same. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, I'm sure you have questions. I would like to start. Okay, right up at the top.
I could just...
Can you project?
Yeah.
Okay.
So thanks for that great presentation. Mine is just a pedestrian question. You spoke about being kicked out of the book and then in Flint. Could you say a little more about that? 2001, why?
Yeah. Oh, well... Well, you know, my first memory of Plettenberg Bay, I'm sure most people know about the Group Areas Act and things. My mom, in that time, was classified white when we were kids under Group Areas Act. And so my first memory of Plettenberg Bay and Central Beach was just watching everyone on the beach and we were sitting in the car. And I remember being in my bikini, wondering when we were going to, you know, get into the water. And also coming from the coast, I practically lived on the beach. And my dad, I remember, we'd sit in the car and we'd just watch people. And I remember asking my dad, well, you know, why can't we go to the beach? And he said, because we're dark and we're not allowed on this beach. And I said, but everyone's trying to get dark. Like, we're already there. It was like, we should be like the first ones on the beach. And so my mom would go out and get us ice cream and come back to the car. And I just remember thinking my dad was the most evil man on the planet. And then later on, after understanding apartheid, and my uncle and I were very close, and he would tell me stories that my dad refused to. I think because there was so much shame around apartheid, and people forget that. You know, we think, oh, we kind of just like went over a step, and we're like, oh, it's all over now. We all okay. My dad still holds all that shame. That to this day, if I say, Dad, my book launch is here, come. And he says, hey, but why there? It's not for us. And they won't understand us. You know, the us and them still. And on either side, it still happens. And so when I went to Plettenberg Bay in 2001, it was my graduate year, it was it was just two of my friends. So there's Sharon, who's from Kimberley, who's Chinese, and Wendy, who's Santon Kugel. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to use that word, but you know, like really, you know, she's blonde and with her high heels, but not on the beach. And so the three of us were on the beach, and Sharon and I got asked to leave the beach. So not just me. So Sharon, who's of Chinese descent, they just came up to us, a group of people saying, well, what are you doing here? And so Sharon's immediate response, oh, we're hanging out. And I, because I had my memories of Plettenberg Bay and Dad's restrictions, I just said, don't talk to them. And so Wendy, on the other hand, was like, oh, we should leave immediately. How rude. And I said, I'm not going anywhere. You know, I think the democracy needs to be, people need to catch up. I'm there already. I'm not leaving the beach. I wasn't allowed in, you know, when I was 10. I'm allowed now. So that experience. And then also, I think the Bloemfontein, my last experience there, Wendy and I were going from Johannesburg to Cape Town, driving through. We stopped in Bloemfontein to get pizza. And the table next to me, they came to me and they said, you shouldn't be here. So, they will get takeaways. Yeah. I don't know what more to say, except for that. And so I don't stop in Bloemfontein anymore.
We have another question.
I'm just curious to know, are you involved? I've got a feeling that Cape Town is a design center.
Well, design capital.
So, is anything happening around it, or do you know about anything, or are you involved with anything?
Yes. Well, the thing is, the World Design Capital, firstly, and this is really just the perspective of designing South Africa and my own, that I feel, well, the World Design Capital is very much like the World Cup. We bid for it. So Cape Town bid for the title. It wasn't ordained, like, you're a successful, amazing design city and we'll give you this prize. So that's already an issue for me. But I feel like that it is there now. And how can we galvanize design communities to get better involved? I think the World Design Capital and other kind of status things or titles don't influence our work at all. Because once the World Design, the title is gone, we keep working in design and activating these design initiatives. But I'm curious to see how they're managing it. I know the City of Cape Town have asked Designing South Africa to do a whole bunch of activities next year for the World Design Capital. But I need to see how the management is moving ahead with that. So I don't have any answers yet.
If I could just ask a question, seeing that you're the expert here.
I understood that they were selected, you know, there were three in the running in the end, or four, I can't remember. That it was a prospective thing. They weren't valued for what they'd done in the past. It was something that was going to happen in the future.
The bid book. Yeah, I think you see Cape Town amongst many other cities bid for the title. Because I think the forefathers of the bidding process thought that it would bring more attention to Cape Town, more tourism, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Very similar to what the World Cup had initiated. And then also remember the World Design Capital. And I'm being a huge cynic here, I really am. But the World Design Capital itself is only, I think, 6 years old, 6 or 8 years old maybe, and it happens, I think, every 2 years. A group of industrial designers called ICSIT, an association of industrial designers, they had registered a trademark, World Design Capital, and then they asked cities around the world to bid for it. That's literally what it is. So I'm sorry if I don't take it too seriously. I take what we do a little more seriously. Yeah. I'm just sharing the process with you. So naturally, when the City of Cape Town comes to me and says, will you activate something around it? I'm very happy to do it. But I'm not in the background going, ooh, World Design Capital, yay, you know. Yeah. I feel like our activities need to be demonstrated. And while you're demonstrating them and actually creating things, you should share with a global and local audience, rather than making the claim first and then delivering maybe later, if we can, as well.
Okay. Let me stop here. I'll come across.
I'm really excited about your input on social housing. I was at a housing delivery protest in Grahamstown in Extension 10. Now, I understand that that is on the periphery of the periphery of the periphery. It's almost in Fort Beaufort. And there, people were saying, you know what? Thank you for giving us houses, but let us have a say. These are north-facing. They're on a windy, terrible windswept.
Yes.
I can't describe to you what the plane is like. It's really awful. Why can't we have a say, whether we have breeze block or whatever? And there's just no communication. And the attitude of the housing official that came there from Bishu was, what are you moaning about? We're giving you a house for free. So how do you change that idea?
Well, I think this image for me says it all.
You let him say it.
The process there is you tender for the design of the house and the management of the project like that. So then, if I get the tender, I must ask this lady to design the house for me.
Yes.
But in the process, I must consult with the community maybe and ask them, how do you want the house on the hill, this and that.
Yes.
But in the meantime, it's only the architect and the project manager. And you can't tell an architect how to draw the house. You can't tell him how to design the house. Mm. And what he say is final. Then he goes to the engineer. Mm. And those guys, I think they have a superior attitude towards
yes, absolutely.
People.
Well, that's what I was alluding to earlier. The procurement process is not successful in South Africa. So for instance, well, look at this image. So they said somebody wrote a brief, and this applies to the exhibitions we're putting out there that I mentioned in Shanghai, as well as the housing. So I know it may sound ridiculous, but it's true, because our systems in the background are not successful. So for instance, somebody in the housing department said, oh, there's a piece of land that has been identified for housing. So instead of actually going into Deep Sloot and saying, what are the services? Ah, you don't have water and sanitation. Let's start there. So they have earmarked, because they've already promised 1 million houses to people. So there's a delivery and tick-off box. So they've identified a piece of land, and there we go. No road, there's no park, no playground for little kiddies. I don't see a soccer field anywhere, no hospital. So nothing, basically, that people need to actually survive, except a structure and also a checklist to say we did 1 million houses. So what we are pushing as Designing South Africa is to go to government. And the other thing is the tender process is the same thing with the exhibitions. I've seen these forms. They go to the bricks. How many bricks are you going to use? Rather than the people and what the people need. So bricks, so from the exhibition side, how many plug points and boards can you cost and what is it going to cost? And then in the housing checklist, how many bricks and cement bags are you going to use? So nowhere in these two, what stories you want to tell, how you want to engage, and are people going to be happy at the end of it? Who was spoken to? So the architects I work with are the ones that actually go into these informal settlements, existing homes of people, and see how they live, and see what is it the Marlborough South resident said, water, sanitation, dignity. So basically start there. And every brief starts with a conversation. So the architects I work with, and they engage with academic institutions as well, like University of Johannesburg. So the particular story I'm talking about is Marlborough South. They used their students, 50 students in total. They went into Marlborough South, and the students, each of them got a group, and they spoke to different community leaders, and they said, we need this. There was a rat problem. There was a cold seeping in. There was a light issue. And all of these architects are equipped to work on and to work with. And so while this was all happening with the University of Johannesburg and Marlborough South, evictions took place. So what an amazing, their democratic process, the students were seeing right in front of them, that the people that they were trying to help through the University of Johannesburg were being evicted without a single warning, huh? No notice was sent to these people. So then they broke down all their infrastructure that people had created themselves in abandoned warehouses, and not even relocated, they just gave them temporary tents. And midwinter, where's the democracy in that? And where's the discussion? So I feel on one side there are architects, and certainly the ones I'm working with, that are completely engaged. And there they're already engaging their students, and from there they're engaging a greater public. And there are organizations like myself that push government to activate a little more. And the way we do that is through the media and through the exhibitions that we take internationally. So in developing design in South Africa, the other thing that I saw, a lot of government organizations would say no to me. As soon as I said, oh, I have the Financial Times there and they're chairing the panel discussion, all of them attended. So this is the other way. And so two amazing things would happen along that process, On one side, we got amazing publicity to tell our stories, but not sugar-coated stories, the actual realities of it. And it's a South African story. Don't be ashamed of it. But on the other hand, we got governments to come to sit at the table because media was involved. And the media, when you asked them to sit on the sideline and take notes, they were chairing the discussions. And that's very, very important. And so I'm not sure if I answered your question or addressed it in any way. But I think on one side, there is a procurement process that is failing South Africa, and that is the cheapest boat. And these guys are not even architects, I'll have you know. They're just property developers or construction mafia. And they get some draftsmen to do the buildings that you see in front of you, with no research, no community engagement. But that there's the architects I deal with that have that do it all, and I'm learning so much from them. And hopefully over the course of the year, we'll reveal all, or at least reveal as much as we can. So.
First of all, thanks for your talk. I appreciate it. It raises lots of ideas and questions, so I appreciate
that.
Yeah,
I know the questions.
Yeah. I was interested by your comment that democracy happens in cities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a, I think that's really interesting. But I'm worried that it also makes it seem like democracy doesn't happen in rural areas. And so I wondered, I mean, do you think that if it's not happening in rural areas, how could it? And I wondered if you wanted to speak to that a little bit.
I'm not saying that it doesn't happen in rural areas. I'm saying cities, the reason I'm focusing so much on cities, especially with our work, is that all democracies pan out in a city environment, like in a really like hot box of activities in concentrated form. So like the worst and the best scenarios will happen in a dense situation because you're all like, in a rural area, there's huge distances, maybe only one kind of tribe of people or group of people or culture. So they're not really jostling and having to interact the way they happen in cities, for instance. So I only make that reference not to say that they don't happen. The other thing that's quite particular in South Africa compared to like a South American model and a South African model, which I find quite interesting. In South America, when people leave their rural area, they leave. They set up in the city and that is it. They take their gokos, and their tias and everyone in South America, they all live together. Whereas in South Africa still, I mean, the MD of APSA is going to still take a lot of his money into the rural area because, and he or she continues to visit these places. So the economy of South Africa is filtering. I mean, we have 64% of South Africa's population living in cities, but the economy is filtering through still. So it's not just concentrated in the cities because people that are living in the cities are still also connected to very much to their rural homelands.
Sure.
We can use that word, or rural areas.
I'm going to close the session, sorry, because people do have other shows to go to.
And I'm still available.
Zahira is here, so will you come down and put your question to her. Thank you, Zahira. That was fantastic. It was really interesting to be exposed to all that in just the space of 45 minutes. Thank you so much.